comparison for that was that Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now is completism, mm-hmm. and Joni Mitchell's A Case of You is completionism.
I love the Mitchell Matrix. I think this is a great way to think Matrix. About it. I also think like the first lines of A Case of You are like some of the best lyrics like of all time.
How does it start again?
I think it starts just before Love Got Lost. You said, I'm as constant as a northern star.
Yeah, that's great.
And then she says, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? Mm-hmm. If you want me, I'll be in the bar.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
I have to admit, that's like, that part was never sticky in my head. I just always think, yeah, I'm not going to try to sing. My voice is terrible, but...
No, do it.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, I want okay. you to distract everyone while I readjust myself? My light, because uh-huh. I really don't like the way it is.
Well, I just like it when she goes, you know, I could drink... Okay.
Stop. No. See, you're right. You, it's a that
bad
was
idea.
Not...
Bad idea.
Tom,
I'm not a singer.
We will need you to cut that
out. Please cut that out. Not a joke. Yeah.
Not kidding. Not kidding.
Look, I'm not a singer. I played saxophone.
Let's we should go to karaoke sometime. Though.
Yes.
We should do Taste Line karaoke. Well, do you have a karaoke song?
I do. I do. What do you think it is? There's nothing to go on here. What do you think my karaoke song is?
No, this is better. I'm going to pull something from the ether. I'm a Believer by Smash Mouth.
No, it's not that. It is Dancing in the Dark by Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, that's Ben's, one of Ben's songs.
It's a banger. It's a classic.
What do you think mine is?
Okay, I'm also going to get this totally wrong. I don't think that it's this, but I think this would be a nice one for you, which is Manhattan by Cat Power.
Oh, that's very flattering. Mm-hmm. It's actually You're So Vain by Carly Simon.
That's okay. That's actually much more on brand. That's perfect.
I'm not going to sing.
No.
I let you fall on your face.
You led me right into the mud with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's my job.
That is your job. Into the dirt.
First mic, mud mic, second mic, bad influence
Wait,
mic.
Who's the first mic?
You.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I have jester's privilege on this podcast. Yeah,
that's a lot of responsibility to be first mic.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Heavy is the head that wears the Sony, the $90 Sony headphones. I'm thinking about Instagram Reels. We talked about Instagram Reels a couple
Why?
Times ago. Because I spend... I don't want to talk screen time.
Stop doing that.
There's one that is stuck in my head right now that I hate, and it's one of the ones I don't follow and I choose not to follow, but I haven't yet blocked him. Actually, you know who I did block? Are you familiar with Tony P?
Yeah, I think so.
Tony P in DC.
Mm.
A Day in My Life as a 25-year-old bachelor in Washington, DC.
Okay, well, I remember that.
Yeah.
That crossover.
I had to block him. It was making me mad. I don't know. It's like this... It's so, like, his whole thing is that he, like, wants to be a dad, that he's, like, a dad in training, that he's, like, an old soul, that he's, like, 40 years old. And at first, I thought it was kind of,
Does he have a girlfriend?
He has had at points, you know, when he makes
Okay, again, revealed preferences is going to be a big theme on this podcast. He doesn't want to be a dad.
Revealed preferences. I've never heard that phrase.
I've literally said it on, like, every single episode.
Okay, well, I haven't been listening to this podcast. I just talk on it.
Well, I listen multiple times so that I can improve.
Yeah,
but that's fine. Second mic things.
Okay. Wow. Jester's privilege once again.
So, I mean, it's an economic thing. Like, you ask consumers, what do you care about? They might say one thing in a survey, but the stuff that they buy is like totally different. So they'll say like, I eat healthy, but then all they buy is frozen pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Me. So yeah, it's like when people are like, I really want to have, I hate drama. I hate drama in relationships, but then they repeatedly date people who are like kind of unhinged.
Oh, yeah.
So people have like carried over this into like other stuff, or they're like, I just want to settle down and have a family, but they're 40 years old and they date 23-year-olds who clearly do not want to be mothers yet. So that's like, I think
self-gaslighting.
It's self-delusion. It's like the narrative. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. You know, as somebody like that, it's like, oh, I want to be a father, but are you dating
but he's
your
a
child's mother? Are you looking for your child's mother? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fine. I mean, I also am like, you can do dad things and not be a dad. That's totally fine. I mean, you don't own those concepts, but it does seem like a little bit of a gap between the self story and the reality.
Tony P, we don't believe you. I don't think you want to be a dad. Our guest is here, our very first guest here on the Tasteland podcast, Casey Lewis, author of the After School newsletter and the new After School podcast class of summer 2024. I've had her on the Creator Spotlight podcast and newsletter 6 months ago or so. Casey rules, one of my favorite newsletters. Let's chat. What's up,
hey
Casey?
Guys.
Hey, Casey.
I just saw if you saw me laughing, I just saw a tweet that says, in quotes, I want grandkids. And then the response is, best I can do is a newsletter, which made me LOL.
That's kind of a, yeah. Well, Casey, how's it going? It's been like 6 months since we last potted.
Yes. Good. How are you? Congratulations, you guys. I what a dream team, you two.
Mm-hmm. What a dream team having you here too. I mean, like I was just saying, the podcast, I need to stop saying this, the podcast class of summer 2024. We'll see who graduates in 4 years.
It's never too late to start a podcast, right?
Yes, I do agree. To start a podcast, to start a newsletter, all of it.
Mm-hmm. So when I talked to you like 6 months ago, you had just quit your job to do the newsletter full time. This was... Yeah, I think I talked to you in February. It was like came out in March, something like that. Has it been? How's it been? Is it a success? How do you feel?
You know, it's funny. I was so excited to have all this time to sort. You know, because my job was not a 9-to-5. It was like like any job. But so I felt like I was going to have all of this time and all of this brain space. And the same week that was my last day at work, I also moved and got a puppy. And so it was honestly like the most stressful point of my life, which was worse. It felt bad because I was leaving what was a wonderful but stressful job. Mm-hmm. And I was like, my life is going to be stress-free. And then it ended up being so much more stressful. And so I kind of felt a bit like a failure because I was not as productive as I wanted to be for a couple of months there. But the puppy is settling in, the boxes are gone. And so I'm feeling productive again.
Well, congratulations. I didn't notice any drop-off in the newsletter for what it's worth.
I tried really hard not to, but like the moving stuff is just the most boring thing to talk about, but also like one of those life really derails the life.
Yeah.
What kind of puppy do you have?
Well, it's funny that you should ask because he's right here.
Oh my goodness.
That's like a dog. That's not a puppy. Yeah. That's a dog.
Yeah. He's really good, but man, he's been a handful. We thought that he was going to be like 2 to 3, mm-hmm. and he's more like 1, mm-hmm. and so has like tons of energy and just needed to be walked pretty much constantly.
Is he a pity lab mix?
So we just got his DNA test. He looks like a pity lab, mm-hmm. and I grew up with labs, and so I hoped that he was a pity lab, but he is 100% pity.
Aww.
And the same kind of pity. Like he, mm-hmm. you know, there's like American Bully. There's like all kinds of pities. He's 100% Pitbull Terrier.
Such a sweetie.
Thank you.
So one more thing about catching up on the newsletter. When I talked to you, you had 40,000 subscribers and 2,000 paid subscribers. Are the numbers healthy? Numbers gone up?
The numbers have gone up. However, I've gotten a little more aggressive about purging. Mm. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how often you guys do this, but probably like once a month, I'll sort of dive into my open rate and get, you know, specifically with Substack, it seems like, and you guys don't have this problem because neither of you are on Substack.
We're both on Beehive.
Yeah.
Both on Beehive, company line, but we are going to talk about Substack later.
Yes.
Lot to talk about there, but it's hard to tell if the quality of subscribers that come through the Substack app are actually like, are they just checking a box and then they're sudden? Like, I don't know. I try to like really stay on top of my open rate. So all that's to say I'm at 48. Mm-hmm. So that's some growth.
Well, the number that matters is the premium number. Are more people paying you to write your newsletter?
Oh, yes. I am seeing the premium number go up, which is always exciting. Though it's never as like high as as the amount of like time, blood, sweat, and tears go into it. I'm always like, damn it. But there's so many newsletters at this point that it's like, I get it.
Okay, so we should talk about this. Emily Sundberg's essay from like a week ago now, The Machine in the Garden. I think it's been reverberating around the newsletter world. Many newsletters that have been sent that are takes on this newsletter. The gist, I don't know if there's one gist. Kind of the gist, though, is that there's too many newsletters that aren't good enough where people are expecting, people to pay for 10 links of things they think they should buy, right?
My read's a little bit different. That is one interpretation for sure. And also, I talked to Emily yesterday and told her, we're going to talk about it on the podcast. Is there anything that you want to add about the response? And then she, last night's Feed Me was like a voice memo from her where she talks about how, like a previous piece that she wrote for New York Magazine about Shopee shops, this piece is a little bit of an inkblot test of what people want to see. And I think there is one interpretation that's like, Substack has created this ecosystem where it's so easy to toggle on subscriptions and ask people to pay for your writing without deeply considering whether what you're writing is worth paying for. That's one interpretation. To me, it's more about the context collapse that happens in an ecosystem like Substack, where some people are using it in a professional way and some people are using it as hobbyists. But everyone is using the same tools and everyone is, to attach a term to it, a writer. And this really like strikes at like why Francis and I started the podcast, because I think, I have a slide in a recent presentation I did that where I call this the creator economy trap, which is everyone has to promote their hobby in the same way that they promote their business because of the amount of noise in the attention economy and the creator economy, which exists, they're the same. They're just two layers of the same information ecosystem. But if you're like Substack is your hobby, but you are marketing it in the same way you would market a business, people start to have expectations of you where they view themselves as your customer, especially if they're paying for it. And I don't know that some of these platforms have done enough to address that, these different use cases, because everyone's getting it and you're experiencing it all on the same app feed. And I think the context collapse is really, to me, the most salient part, not even the quality of the writing, but like, how are people viewing their writing? Like, what is their intention?
Well, I think with the writing, one thing on the context collapse is Rachel Carton then had a great response as a note, who writes the Lincoln Bio newsletter, another great newsletter. She wrote a Substack note about it that I think kind of captures what you're saying, that like the problem is that on Substack, Substack's become a social media app. So then like when you're seeing somebody's newsletter out of context of like you subscribe to their newsletter and it's in your inbox and you're actually seeing it like on like the Substack notes feed reblogged, like then that's just wrong. Like it's not meant to be seen that way. You're meant to see it in the context of like, if somebody is sending two essays a week and then one like links roundup, like the links roundup then has meaning in that it's like that person's curated take. Whereas when you're seeing three links roundups from three different people, two of whom you don't follow in your feed at once, then it's like, then it's really devalued.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about all of this, I didn't realize that many people were using the Substack app in this way, and especially getting content that they don't subscribe to. And I personally don't use it in that way. So I guess I'm curious about you guys as Beehive writers. How do you think about the Substack app? Do you think it is as important as, did you guys read the Jess Graves essay about edfluency?
No, what's edfluencing?
My like brain immediately, because my mom is an educator, goes to like, is this edutainment? But no, this is editor meets influencer. And she has this really interesting article that went sort of viral like Emily's, and Emily covered it as well. And I thought her take was interesting. And I will say Jess published this article publicly, and then it started to create so much conversation that then she paywalled the whole thing, which I thought was super interesting and smart, obviously. But just her thought, her point of view was, you know, she came up like in agency world. She was an early days fashion influencer. She got on Substack early in terms of relative to other fashion Substackers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you guys are deeply entrenched in the fashion Substack subset, nor am I, but I follow one.
Laura Riley.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like Laura is sort of like she has her own thing to me, like mm-hmm. what she's doing, but there's a lot of TikTokers and fashion TikTokers and fashion influencers who mm-hmm. who have started expanding onto Substack, which mm-hmm. is really interesting to see someone who mostly is aggregates video or photo mm-hmm. trying to translate to Substack. So Jess's point was, it was very much like, almost like Substack, fashion Substack hierarchy. There's like infighting a little bit. She touched on there's backlash when these influencers get so big that then they are now wearing only the Row, but they used to, you know, maybe recommend H&M.
And then it's like
just
so
some really interesting. Yeah. But her essay initially struck me as like, I didn't realize that people viewed Substack as such a, you know, I think about it as sort of like Blogger back in mm-hmm. the day, which like Frances, as you know, I had a vlog on Blogger back in the day, but it was just merely a platform, right? Like it was a tool. There were blog roles.
Yeah. That, like not that, a platform.
You know, yeah. But it wasn't a platform. It was merely a place. It gave you the tools to publish your work. And that's very much how I view Substack and always have is like, it is like MailChimp in many ways. It's better than MailChimp in many ways, but so the fact that there's this sort of Substack ecosystem, I have a hard time understanding like how big it is and how valid it is as an ecosystem. And are we giving Substack too much credit for what it, and I'm curious with you guys being on Beehive, how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think because Beehive, I think of Beehive and like other things like Ghost as like, you know, a tool, whereas Substack is like decidedly both a social media platform and a media company itself, which is like partially in how Substack monetizes, right? Like they take a 10% cut of your paid subscriptions. So it's almost like you are a like I forget if I hadn't talked to Ryan Broderick yet when I interviewed you, but he had this great thing. I was like, what's a creator? And he said, it's an Uber driver for posts, where that's what it is on Substack because of that business model. And then Substack itself is like, you're like every writer on Substack, because of that payment model, is almost like not quite a freelance writer for Substack, the media company, but you're not.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas like other things like Beehive, like Ghost, these other platforms that like don't have this like walled app, social media platform, like those are decidedly tools, right? Like I don't think of myself as, I mean, I'm paid by Beehive, so I guess I am a Beehive writer, but I don't think of myself as like a Beehive writer.
Oh yeah, you
writer.
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the way that there's a
You're especially a Beehiver.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I was actually struck this in my morning scroll in bed, like bleary eyed this morning. Marie Claire posted a story that was like, the designer behind Substack's favorite loafers is coming for your closet.
Yeah.
And I thought as a headline in a women's fashion magazine, how interesting that was, that, you know, and when you read it, if you don't know, like
I just bought John Gans's new book, When the Clock Broke, and I was like reading the inside jacket cover. What's the name of his newsletter again?
No.
Okay. I forget what it is, but it says he writes the, whatever the name of his newsletter is, for Substack. Didn't say on, it said that he writes it for Substack in the cover, the jacket cover of the book. Okay. Another thing I want to bring in though, too, Julia Alexander, who writes Posting Nexus, which she says is neither a blog or a newsletter. It's on Ghost. Bring a third platform into the mix here. She had this article yesterday, I think a couple of days ago, called People Aren't Posting. What happens when people revolt against social media just becoming media? And she's like, starts it referencing this Wall Street Journal piece that like, I didn't read the actual stats in it, but like these stats that prove like people aren't posting as much as they used to. And she says the problem is that apps like Instagram, which I think applies to a Substack here too, the problem is that apps like Instagram are split into two separate platforms for two separate groups of people, a social connector and an entertainment media center. The goal is to balance incentive. The goal for the company is to balance incentive enough for the latter to ensure that there is enough fodder for the former. And then she also says, last quote, it got me thinking, how do you encourage people to post while expanding the reach of their circle? You lean away from the social component and towards the media side. Friends morph into audiences. Platforms for connecting are no longer designed for relationships. They're designed as media centers. Whereas I think what we're talking about with Substack, designed as a media center, becoming a platform for relationships.
That's super interesting. Super interesting.
So your new podcast came out yesterday. I listened to it. You had two guests. One was this micro influencer, Jenny Duan. And then the other was like the VP of global consumer marketing for Pinterest, which great contrast. But like, I was curious, who is Jenny Duan? How did you find her? Like, I was looking her up and it's like, you know, she has like 6,000 on TikTok, a million likes, but like, so like, who is this person?
Well, she is an after-school reader, and she emailed me earlier this summer. And then in thinking about who I could have on to, like, sort of, I wanted someone who was embedded in TikTok and understood Hall Talk without being so embedded that they were, you know, capital C creator. You know, I wanted someone who, like, understood the landscape a bit. And so she's like a super, I mean, she's a philosophy, computer science major. She is right now a finance intern in New York. She walked in wearing like the coolest, like a white floaty maxi skirt. Like she had pink hair. Like she's so cool. But I felt like she was someone who sort of like showed that, that Gen Z contrast of like, you can be this and this and this. And I think micro influencers have a good perspective because again, they're not like so up there that there are media, they're media trained.
They're more self-aware.
And, yeah, exactly. And they, I wanted someone who wasn't also wanting, like when there's too much pressure to get brand deals or, you know, like I wanted someone who could speak candidly. So yeah, she was cool, right?
Yeah, no, that was good. One thing you were talking about, like, these like back to schools, the Hall Talk, which is like so foreign to me. I mean, I try to stay off TikTok. But yeah, this is something you've been writing about a lot too in recent weeks and after school. What is Hall Talk? What are you learning from Hall Talk?
Yeah. So there are Hall Talk always exists and it existed on YouTube before. Well, I mean, halls.
Well, when you say always, like YouTube. How long ago is always? Sorry to interrupt.
So I'm not a YouTube. I have not spent a significant amount of time on YouTube, but I think for ages, as long as beauty and fashion YouTubers have existed, I think that hauls have been popular content. YouTube is kind of a blind spot for me. It's something that I want to course correct, but it's such a monster that I just, you know, TikTok to me feels a little bit more accessible. But so hauls are, you know, I got this from Abercrombie. Yeah. I got this from Hollister. And the big moments around hauls are back to school and Christmas, where people are talking about what they, you know, what they got from Santa. And it's just, I love it because it's such a peek into what people are buying. And just in terms of like, my favorite thing is, you know, literally just, it's going to be rainy this weekend. And I'm going, my plan is to spend Saturday and Sunday watching back to school hauls and sort of crunching the most popular product, you know, figuring out what are the through, you know, what comes up again and again. And it's always interesting to see. So one of the craziest things that I have seen so far is how popular tube tops are, but for back to school. Like I couldn't wear a tube top to back to school. It's crazy. These like stretchy little tube tops and they're wearing them with like baggy jeans or baggy sweats even. But you know, these things, which I've been doing this now for 3 years. And so to see even differences from last year are fascinating to me. And it, one aspect that's fascinating to me is like, I grew up in rural Missouri. The trends reached me. I think Francis, you and I maybe talked about this. The trends reached me much later than they hit the kids in New York. You know, it's like I got my trends via MTV or teen magazines. And to see the trend cycle collapse in a way that like kids in rural Missouri are seeing are buying the very same things as like kids in New York. I mean, not quite, but you know, close enough.
I'm curious. So when you like these kids, like, is there like, I don't know, are they mostly like college age, high school? Do you think there's like a location where they mostly are? Is it just kind of like all over the states? Yeah,
literally,
who are these people?
Yeah, it's all over. It's literally all over. And right now, like one of the most famous hall girls is this girl, Demetra. She is in New Jersey. She's just like a New Jersey teen. The Wall Street Journal just profiled her. And it's like, she's not a household name. Like no one knows who she is except for teenage girls. And now the Wall Street Journal. And she's able to sell stuff out. But her wardrobe is so simple. She's like wearing low rise jeans from PacSun and baby tees from Brandy Melville. And you're like, this is a style icon. Not that her style is bad, but it's like, you know, I don't mean to bully a teen. She's so cool. But like, you know, it's just sort of remarkable that it's like, this is like who everyone is aspiring to be when it seems
it's
so simple.
It's not innovative. It's relatable.
Exactly.
But in
exactly.
Previous influencer cycles, people have gravitated towards the people who are innovating. Like, I mean, Tavi is an example.
Yes.
Of that. Leandra Medine.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I think we happen to be in a cycle right now where people are especially looking for like almost like the median, but you have to stand out. You know, we've talked about this with startups. It's like you have to stand out enough to break out of the noise. But then the people that break out, you know, whether it's like an Alex Cooper, like Alex Earl, even Emma Chamberlain back in the day, although I think she's come a lot more into really personal style and values. Like they break out of the pack, but they're kind of indistinguishable from their audience.
Yeah.
And I think that dynamic has to, by nature of how paradoxical it is, be short-lived, where either the tide will not turn on that particular person, but that person will have to innovate to maintain their audience, or the next influencer cycle will just kind of the pendulum will swing back to people who are breaking out of the pack because they're not the median. They're an outlier in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a conversation yesterday about clicks and counterculture and what does that look like in 2024 for teenagers, but it makes me think of, you know, startups or influencers or high school kids. It's all the same where you want to blend in enough, but you need to stand out at the same time. You can't be too weird because then that is divisive.
What is counterculture for kids these days?
Yeah. I honestly don't like, for me, I'm like, is counterculture, my best guess is counterculture the kids who are like the kids who are foregoing technology altogether.
That's what I would think.
So yeah, I think that that's the bit, because it's like, what else could counterculture be? I mean, surely there are still like the punk kids and the goth kids, but like for truly
but counterculture. But goth is a Pinterest tag.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Like I listened to the episode too. It's like, it's been fully subsumed by the mainstream if it's
the
a Pinterest
old baddies,
tag.
Daisy.
Jenny kept using the word aesthetic, which I thought was really funny. I feel like aesthetic, that I didn't use that when I was in high school. Maybe I did in college.
Yeah.
And I looked up the Google trend for aesthetic, and
it's huge.
Well, but it was basically flat until around the time I remember it coming about, like 2014, it starts ticking up, but then it peaks September 2020 at like the 100% in like kind of a quick rise. And now it's back down to like 25%. But the way she kept using the word aesthetic, I think is kids didn't talk like that. She's not in high school, but when I was in high school, kids didn't talk. We did in college, I guess. But
I think you're around the time that all of the cores, you know, cottagecore, coquettecore, like when, and that's just before I started after school. But that's sort of what inspired me to start a newsletter. Is I was seeing just so many trend headlines.
Explore the core.
And I was trying to understand like what is all, what is, what to make of it? You know, like, what does it all mean? And this was before I was on TikTok. And so just fascinated by this sort of rise and honestly, the use of aesthetic among young people in terms of like, I have to find my aesthetic or like, what is my aesthetic? And I think that's why Pinterest has become so popular with Gen Z because they're trying to understand. And like, for us, it was like, what is my style? You know, it, but aesthetic for them, it's like, it's not just what is their style. It's tied into their whole, like, who am I?
Yeah. This, yeah. So this reminds me, I saw like a quote tweeted, you know, quote unquote meme on Twitter the other day that was like, it was just like a pink vape with, I think My Year of Rest and Relaxation, the book, like over it. And the quote tweet was just like, this isn't even a meme anymore. Like, this is just like, an identity signifier. Like, memes don't even exist. It's just these like aesthetic things, which when we were talking, Daisy, the other episode about like the Anthony Bourdain starter packs and how it's just like, you know, it's, I don't know. What's the difference, do you think, between aesthetic and style then? Like, you're kind of saying that it's more about like a full identity, but then that's making me think of like when I was like 16, like, you know, reading in English class, I'm like, oh, I got to figure out what my like philosophical outlook on life is. And you read about existentialism. And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm an existentialist. But it's just like, but that's more of like, I guess that's like an aesthetic, right?
And now
it's like,
he's a Hegelian e-girl.
Oh
right?
My God, no, don't go there. But yeah, I guess, yeah, my question is like, what, I'm curious more what you think these kids are saying when they say aesthetic, what we talk about when we talk about aesthetics.
I think they're viewing it as a whole lifestyle. And like with Coquette Core, where it was like, and I know you don't spend a ton of time on TikTok, but it was, I'm sure you've seen these pop up on Reels, where it was like people putting little bows on like their AirPod case and their vape and their water bottle. And yeah, that's a meme, but it also was like turning their entire world into like, okay, I am Coquette Core. That is my aesthetic. And like, we should talk about the demure thing now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to talk about
but
demure.
It's like,
I didn't know about demure until I read it in your newsletter yesterday. And then I was scrolling Instagram Reels later in the day and I got like three in a row. Like, look at me sitting in the airport. I'm so demure. My number hasn't been called up yet. Look at those people standing up. Not demure. It was one of those things that just like, it felt like I was getting so old where I'm like, has this been happening? And I just haven't known about it. Like, what is the, like, I just read about this and now I'm seeing it. Like, how the world's moving too fast.
It is moving so fast. I sat down to write the newsletter over the weekend and I was doing like my deep scroll into TikTok. And it's always so, Daisy, do you spend much time on TikTok?
You know what? I took it off my phone, but
you guys are stronger than me.
Well, but you need it. You do it for a living.
It crosses over to Twitter though. That's the thing. Like, you don't really have to have it anymore to know what's happening.
It's so true. Like the demure thing crossed over immediately. But so I was scrolling and it's like, I saw one TikTok using the word demure and you don't even think about it, right? You're just like, okay, that is a word that exists that I, you know, and it's not weird that one person is using it.
Thousands of words.
Right. Exactly. And then it's like, I like, you know, two TikToks later, I'm like, what the fuck? Like what, like how is that? What? And then, so I like dug into it.
That's not very demure of you. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Casey, that's a little brat. We've moved on.
Oh, no.
But yeah, and then it was one of those things where it was like, this is all over TikTok. By tomorrow, the brands are going to jump. And sure enough, they did. Like, I got onto Twitter on Monday morning. I sent out the newsletter Sunday night. And I'm not saying like I am a trend, like it was, you know, anybody who like was spending a lot of time on TikTok was observing the same things as me. Mm-hmm. And I, on Monday morning, the cracker brand, Chicken in a Biscuit, or do you guys know that cracker brand? It's like chicken flavored crackers. I haven't thought about them in years.
These are for humans or dogs?
They're for humans.
Okay.
They're called.
It's like Cheez-Its, but with chicken bouillon powder.
Biscuit. Yeah, they're called Chicken in a Biscuit Original Baked Snack Cracker.
Look, I would eat it, but I wouldn't be happy about it.
You would eat it demurely.
Exactly. You'd nibble on it. But they did a tweet about very demure, and I saw it Monday morning. And it's like, if this cracker brand is already employing this language, like this, you know, it's
Jover.
But, yeah. Oh no.
What did you say?
It's Jover.
I don't know that.
You don't know. We're so back. It's
you
so
know
Jover.
You know Jover.
Jover?
like Joe Biden.
Yes, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is so Jover.
Yeah.
Brunette roasted. Francis and I were roasted in, well, a couple of comments on my New York Times profile for our vocal fry. And somebody said that it sounded like a disease. And I was like, you know what? Vocal fry is not a disease. Well, but you know what is a disease? Jealousy.
Jealousy. So, I was sick. I was sick in the last two episodes. So it was a disease there for me personally.
You quite literally were sick.
I was sick.
Yeah.
I was sick with
I'm you. Sick. Yeah. Sick of your bullshit.
Everyone comes for that. I feel like that is the number one comment on every single podcast. Like, and they say it about people who don't have, like, it's like, get over it. People,
you know what I think
it
is? It's like just talking into a mic and having the headphones on where you're like, you hear yourself. It's something I easily fall into. But wait, okay. So speaking of the comments, there was another one where producer Tom, shout out to him, he's listening, had cut a clip of me talking about how Ryan Reynolds in Deadpool as a concept, but Ryan Reynolds generally rubs me the wrong way. And somebody on YouTube commented saying I was jealous or something. And I was like, well, like this, you know, YouTube shorts, maybe this will help our engagement. I'll reply. And I said something very demure. I was like, no, like, look, he's successful. Power to him, whatever. Like, just not for me. And the person wrote out this short paragraph and basically accusing me of punching down to Ryan Reynolds, which I found very flattering.
Open the schools.
Yeah. But okay, I want to bring it just briefly back to just thinking about punching down. The first comment on Emily's article that we were talking about earlier, which got like 198 likes, was like that this essay feels like punching down to me. It's easy to critique writing as not up to your standards when you run a popular blog. You're part of the group that sets these standards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like I firmly believe it's better for somebody to write poorly instead of not writing at all. I think this goes back to like kind of a lot of the stuff we've been talking about and like the Emily Sundberg essay, the Julia Alexander essay. I think what it is with so many people making so much content on so many platforms, it's like this desire not to be criticized, which I think is like actually one of the marks of a like professional writer or Instagram creator, TikTok, like anybody actually creating media, like as you know, beyond just content, like creating media for the sake of like trying to build a business. It's like you have to be able to be criticized. And I think another Delia Kai had a good kind of short take in her newsletter on this essay too. That was like the lines blurring between amateurism and professionalism. And I think in this case, that's kind of like one of the lines that was exposed was like, you have to be able to accept being criticized. Like if you want to compete in any of these like crowded content ecosystems, right?
But do these people want to compete or are they just there?
That's a really good question. I think they might want to compete, but not know that that's what they're doing.
Because I think anyone can call themselves a writer, but not everyone is entitled to an audience.
Yes.
And not everyone is entitled to an audience that's going to be willing to pay for their work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I guess what's not clear is for people who are using Substack as a hobby and are happy to, as a hobbyist writer, they call themselves writers and they would like to have an audience to the extent that they would like their work to be read, but they don't have any sort of professional growth strategy. And none of these people, I don't think anyone who falls into that category was specifically called out by Emily's essay, but to the extent that they felt implicated, you know, has Substack done anything or signaled anything to give the impression that if you are on the platform, you are a creator to the extent that you are accepting criticism on what you've created? Or are these people, as Emily sort of suggests, there in the same way that people are on Tumblr, where if somebody was writing on Tumblr, which some Tumblr blogs, I mean, I still use Tumblr. I only post visuals for the most part. Some people use it to write. I think during that heyday, it would be odd it would not be odd for two people writing on Tumblr to get in an exchange with one another, but it would be very odd for an aesthetic criticism or value judgment on the quality of writing of Tumblr to leave the Tumblr ecosystem. Mm. I think I would put like, there was, I mean, I interviewed Kate Zambrino last year. Mm-hmm. She talked about the ecosystem of book bloggers that were talking to one another, I think primarily on WordPress. And sometimes those debates did rise to the level of getting covered in some literary publications or, you know, her book that Heroines did get a pretty harsh review in Jezebel that was pulling in some of the blog origins of it, I think. And like somebody like, I don't know how familiar you are with like somebody like Jessa Crispin, but those book bloggers, some of them did become then columnists. I don't know.
I think, well,
maybe we're going too far.
I think I'll say this. I think with Tumblr, like the answer is like probably no. I mean, I wasn't much on Tumblr, but there probably wasn't this kind of more discourse because Tumblr wasn't really a platform you could monetize. Still isn't. Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't professionalized. It was like the whole thing was that it was about like amateur completism, to bring it back to the beginning. It was about amateur like collecting and distributing stuff and building aesthetics. It wasn't stuff you were like explicitly getting paid for. Which, you know,
that's a really good point. So is it the money that makes a difference? Does money introduce this idea that people should form value judgments on quality?
Yeah, I think that seems fair. I turned on paid subscriptions, I think 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And at first, even though I had like, you know, 5 or 10 paid subscriber or, it starts small. I felt like so much pressure to make sure that they were giving them like enough value. And I still stress out about it. Like, am I like someone is giving me their money? Am I doing enough? Like, do they feel like they like, especially with the economy being what it is,
thousands of paid subscribers would say yes.
And that certainly helped, like seeing that number and seeing the, you know, that people continue to renew, like that feels to me like, okay, my quality is high, but it's still something that I think about all the time. And when I notice that a typo makes it through, especially in the long edition, because it's like, sometimes it'll be 4,000 words and there's tons of TikTok embeds. And so if I see something later that slipped in, I like really have a hard time not beating myself up over it. Like, mentally, that I find that to be because I'm like, they're paying me for this work. Yeah. So I do think, and I've paid for some Substacks and then they sort of fall off and don't continue publishing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but I paid you.
Well, what the heck?
Like, and there is sort of an assumption and it's like people go through stuff. Like a lot of times if you're paying, you know, $50 annually, you're doing that with the understanding that they may or may not continue. But the hope and the expectation, especially once you've established a cadence, I think the same goes for podcasting where it's like, I know that Tasteland will come out every Wednesday morning and you have that sort of like built up like expectation.
Trust and then consistency.
Yeah. Like I listen to How Long Gone because I walk my dog so much and I know that there are going to be new episodes Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Yeah.
And when they went on vacation, I was like, well, what am I supposed to listen to on my dog walk? It's also, I could talk to you guys a lot about how hard it is to discover podcasts that are inside of your interest where it's like, there's got to be a million other podcasts along the lines of How Long Gone or, about taste, about zeitgeist, about culture. And it's like, how can I not find other podcasts about trends? I know they exist, but the platforms are to make it so hard to find. I think Tasteland is a brilliant name for a podcast because it's like, if someone is interested in zeitgeist, taste, like culture, it's like immediately identifiable. Also, I think the logo is brilliant because when you're, as I learned just in thinking about launching a podcast, you know, the logo matters so much where you want to be able to like, when I'm walking my dog, I want to be able to tell like, oh, without like getting too close, you know? Brilliant job
logo. Logo was Francis, name was me. And then
it's a big clap.
We both got really attached to the idea of licensing this specific MJ Lenderman song and actually got connected with his manager through Alex Goldman, another
amazing
iconic podcaster. So thank you, Alex. And
I was gonna say it's probably about time to wrap up here, so you know, if you want to listen to that MJ Lenderman song, you're in luck. It's about to play. Casey Bumping also that. Just launched a very good podcast about the zeitgeist called After School, which also has a great logo. So go listen to it. Thanks for coming on, Casey.
Thanks, Casey.
Thank you so much, guys.